Meeting of the House Judiciary Committee to order. It is 1:18 p.m. on Wednesday, April 6th. Before we begin, I want to thank Shannon McCain, the House Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Talia Ames from the Juneau LIO, who makes sure we have sound. At this time, I want to remind committee members and those in the room to please silence your cell phones. Present today, we have Representative Snyder, my vice chair, and myself, Representative Clayman, and Representative Christ Tompkins. We do not need a quorum to start our business today. Our first and only order of business today, or not that only, but first order of business is House Bill 339, States Historical Artifacts Crime, sponsored by the House Rules Committee by request of the governor. This is the first hearing of that bill in the House Judiciary Committee. On teams to present the bill is Judy Bittner, Chief Office of History and Archaeology, Department of Natural Resources. Please identify yourself for the record. You may begin your remarks. I think you're still muted, Ms. Bittner.
There you go. All right.
That's much better. Now we can hear you.
Okay. Through the chair to the House Judiciary Committee members, my name is Judy Bittner. I am the Chief of the History and Archaeology of the Office of History and Archaeology, Division of Parks and Outdoor Recreation, Department of Natural Resources. The Office of History and Archaeology provides statewide historic preservation programs to identify, document, study, evaluate, protect, restore and exhibit prehistoric archaeological and historic sites and buildings. The office works under state and federal authorities, the Alaska Historic Preservation Act and the National Historic Preservation Act. The office also serves as the State Historic Preservation Office, administering federal historic preservation programs and serving as liaison to federal agencies representing the state's interests in protecting its heritage resources and ensuring the federal agencies are complying with federal historic preservation laws and regulations.
Ms. Bittner?
Yes.
Can you take a brief pause? Sometimes procedural realities get our script a little out of order, and because one of the committee members is going to actually have to leave momentarily, can I get a motion to adopt the committee substitute for House Bill 339.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I move that House Judiciary Committee adopt the committee substitute to House Bill 399, version 32-GH2541/I as our working document.
Are there any objections? Hearing and seeing none, then we have adopted the committee substitute to House Bill 399. Thank you very much for that brief interruption. Ms. Bittner, please continue.
Okay, I'm just going to give you a little background on what our office does in the major programs that we work on. And in the federal programs include Section 106 Project Review, maintaining an inventory, the Alaska Heritage Resource Survey, which has over 50,000 listings of historic properties and over 30,000 digitized records. We administer the National Register of Historic Places program, the Historic Preservation Tax Credit Program. We also encourage and provide grants for historic preservation planning. We administer a certified local government historic preservation program, providing grants and training to local governments participating in this program. We engage in outreach and education, and we provide historic preservation grants to owners of historic properties. Under the state program, the Alaska Historic Preservation Act, we issue culture resource permits for investigations on state lands. We are staffed to the Alaska Historical Commission, which also serves as our review board for our federal program. We also maintain an inventory under state authorities, and we assist in the administration of designated sites and monuments, and we also serve as the Geographic Names Board. And do you want me to address the bill that you just introduced?
Yes, please. Tell us about the bill.
Okay, the purpose of the the bill 33399 is to enhance protection for artifacts and prehistoric, historic, and archaeological sites through increased criminal penalties for violations of the Alaska Historic Preservation Act. And that is kind of in a nutshell what started this amendment to the Alaska Historic Preservation Act.
And just a couple of questions. It looks like part of what's doing is adding a mental state for some of these. Is it a crime today, or is it creating a crime for what is not a crime today?
Through the chair, there are criminal penalties today. I think it is trying to clarify the penalties and increase and add a felony to the unlawful acts. So you would have both a felony and a misdemeanor. And working with the Department of Law and others, I think they thought that having the mental state would help with the prosecutions or just the implementation of the penalties with intentional acts, particularly when there is artifacts are being sold and transported, and that when somebody is vandalizing or removing artifacts without a permit.
So I see Ms. Schroeder in the audience, and I know enough about the question that I'm about to start asking that I know you're going to ask for a lifeline, so I'm going to ask the lifeline to come up first.
Thank you.
I know we also have online for questions Christopher Orman, Assistant Attorney General, Civil Division, Department of Law, and Laura Boomerstein, Legislative Liaison, Department of Natural Resources. Okay, Ms. Schroeder, this is back to law school days. This is existing statute that currently has within Title 41, we have these crimes already existent. What's the mental state without, this bill will add a mental state. What's the mental state without the bill?
For the record, Casey Schroeder, Assistant Attorney General for the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. Mr. Chairman, we would argue that it is the default mental state in Title 11, which is knowing as to conduct and reckless as to circumstance. The inclusion of the mental states here was to clarify and assist practitioners and hopefully reduce argument, because occasionally we can argue about that stuff when it's outside of Title 11. So this is just an attempt to make it clearer.
And what would be the common law, to the extent the argument is that, let me start again. Do you agree that there has to be a mental state? That's a pretty long standard in common law, both under U.S. Supreme Court precedent in Alaska. So even if it doesn't state a mental state, there's got to be a mental state. What would be the common law argument about the mental state in the existing statute if Title 11 didn't apply?
Mr. Chairman, it would likely be us arguing that it was some sort of negligence. And I think that we want to avoid those types of arguments and then potentially bad case law.
So the Department of Law would be arguing the mental state is negligence for the criminal conduct, and the defense would be arguing a higher mental state than, I assume what you mean by the criminal negligence as opposed to ordinary negligence, but you'd be arguing the lower mental state and the defense would be arguing something else.
Mr. Chairman, it's possible that we could get a prosecutor that would want to argue a lower mental state. I will tell you, though, the way that these crimes are drafted, it is very hard to imagine something that's not intentional or knowing. I think that would be a tough argument for us to win, but that's why we're including them to try to reduce that level of argument so we can focus on the prosecution.
And then how frequently today are these crimes prosecuted?
Mr. Chairman, not frequently. I did look at that, and we have record of one full prosecution and two total referrals.
What do you mean by two total referrals?
We had one referred in 2014, 2015, and that prosecution is complete. We have another, a more recent referral, and that it's unclear whether or not that will go to prosecution.
Okay. Assuming you referred to your department to make a decision about whether to prosecute, as opposed to, I was thinking these were cases that came in, you referred them to the federal government to follow up on.
No.
Can you give us any insight? My impression is that fish and wildlife and artifact cases are more often show up in federal court than in state court. And is that a accurate perception on my part? Inaccurate? What, can you provide any insight on that?
Mr. Chairman, I know that we quite frequently prosecute fish and game. I don't know the frequency of which we punt cases to the federal government, but we do have a position for a prosecutor that focuses on those crimes. So we do prosecute them with some frequency.
And aren't the ones that you see commonly in the department more wanton waste of fish and game and kind of hunting and fishing violations that have to do with how the hunting took place, as opposed to like Lacey Act violations on the federal level, which is more about the species that was taken as opposed to the manner that it was taken?
That would be correct, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. And under the, what's the distinguishing feature in the proposed bill between what bumps the conduct up from the misdemeanor level to felony level?
Mr. Chairman, as the CS is drafted, Section 1 would be a misdemeanor and Section 2 would be a felony. That's how the CS is currently drafted.
And what distinguishes the conduct, if you can give me an example?
Mr. Chairman, Section 1 deals with excavating, removing, and like destroying the artifact, and Section 2 deals with transporting, buying, or selling, or possessing the artifact. So that's the distinguisher between the conduct.
Any other questions from members? Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question is actually for Ms. Bittner. Nice to see you, Ms. Bittner. I don't know if you can see me on the team screen, but I'm down here at the end of the table. The division that you work for generally preserves all of these resources that were referred to in this act in place in their original situation where previous human beings left them. Is that correct? Or do some of these artifacts find their way to, say, a museum or a display in a state building or something like that?
Through the chair, Representative Drummond, both would be correct that we try to preserve the artifacts and sites in place, and that's when we have a permit to excavate. And then when artifacts are removed through permit, they are reposited in the museums. Either the State Museum is a state repository, and the Museum of the North at University of Alaska Fairbanks, and other museums and tribes can borrow them for displays in their own museums.
Follow up?
Representative Drummond.
And in terms of how these resources are preserved when, say, an industry wants to explore the right-of-way for a pipeline and it's going through potentially historic, prehistoric lands that may contain artifacts. I have a friend who is an, see if I can remember his title. I want to say he's a sociological archaeologist. I forget his exact title, but he's worked on like the pipeline route for the gas pipeline, exploring before the industrial folks get there to make sure that the right of way is not going to be disturbing these items, and if they are disturbing them, I guess the industry has to have a permit to remove them from harm's way. Are you familiar with that, how that process works? And are the permits that are referred to in this bill that kind of permit?
Through the chair, Representative Drummond. Yes, I'm very familiar with the process. We refer to it as a Section 106 process of the project review and the State Historic Preservation. As the State Historic Preservation Officer, I am consulted with on all federal undertakings, licenses, funded projects and permitted projects, as well as state public construction projects. And so we are involved in thousands of projects. When there is a adverse effect on a site, historic property, we go into consultation and negotiate a mitigation for the adverse effect on that property. And if it's on the state property, if it's state site, we will have an agreement, either a programmatic agreement or a memorandum of agreement that spells out the mitigation and the excavation. If they cannot avoid the site, it will be the data will be recovered, and if it is on a state land, it will be the artifacts will either go to University of Alaska Fairbanks Museum of the North or the State Museum in Juneau. If it's on someone else's land, we still get involved in that mitigation because it is part of the state's heritage, and we will be part of the agreement, and I will have to sign the mitigation agreement in the end that directs how that site that will be demolished through the project and how that will be mitigated and what will happen to the artifacts. And sometimes it is the artifacts go to a museum. And there's also other mitigation measures that they might have, interpretive signs. They might document the site. There might be a monograph. There might be some education projects. The type of mitigation can vary.
And one more follow-up.
Quickly, because I know we have another presentation that
okay. We're
going to run out of. We're going to run out of time.
All right. And this also applies to things like electric transmission lines and that sort of thing when they're busting through state property prior to the erection of power lines and all of that. Same kind of care is taken to investigate the potential for archaeological resources.
Through the chair, Representative Drummond, that is correct.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. I don't see any other questions from Ms. Bittner.
I'm happy to ask the question and take the answer in writing for expediency, but if I may.
Yes, please.
I would just love to have an improved understanding, if I could receive it in writing, of the evolution of this bill from draft A to I that we're looking at here. There are quite a bit of differences, and it seems to be a much more concise document that we're looking at here in the CS. And I'm particularly curious what stakeholders, probably namely Alaska Native organizations, were consulted or weighed in to the degree appropriate. I'd love to hear the evolution of this bill and who participated and what instigated this bill. Thank you.
Ms. Schroeder, you're the best person to answer that, and is that a pretty short answer you can give us today?
Mr. Chairman, it's the version before you has taken some time to get to. I would probably want DNR to assist me with how the bill is, why the bill looks the way it does in front of you.
Why don't we hold that question for today and plan when we hear the bill again, if we can we'll put that at the top of the agenda. Okay. So we will hold House Bill 399 for further review. Our second and final order of business today is a presentation from the Uniform Law Commission. We're joined today by Rebecca Polizzotto, Chief Assistant Attorney General, Legislation and Regulations Section, Department of Law, and Chair, Alaska Uniform Law Delegation. Andy Hemingway, a member of the Alaska Uniform Law Delegation, and Deborah Bear, a member of the Alaska Uniform Law Delegation. Please identify yourselves for the record. I'm not sure who all is going to come forward, but probably two of you should, and you can begin your remarks.
For
For the record, Rebecca Palazzato, Chair of the Alaska Delegation, the Uniform Law Commission. Chair Kleiman, members of the commission, or committee, excuse me, on behalf of the commission, thank you for extending an invitation to provide this presentation today. Before we begin, I just wanted to briefly take this opportunity to introduce you to the members of the commission. Some are here in the room, as you just noted. The voting members of the Alaska delegation to the Uniform Law Commission, in addition to myself, are Attorney General Greg Taylor and Chief Justice Daniel Winfrey, both of whom send their regrets they could not be here today. Andy Hemingway, who is with me today and will be making the presentation, is our other voting delegate. We, in addition to the voting members, we have a non-voting ex officio member that you may be familiar with, Megan Wallace. And we have three non-voting life members, and that's Art Peterson, Grant Callow, and Deborah Baer, who is also here today. And those life members certainly have dedicated a great amount of time to this effort. So, respective of your time constraints today, I'm just going to turn it over to Mr. Hemingway to provide the presentation, and Ms. Baer will follow up with some concluding remarks.
And I want to reiterate, thank you very much for the opportunity.
My name the microphone so it's closer to you.
My name is Andy Hemingway. I've been a commissioner on the Alaska delegation to the Uniform Law Commission since 2018. And if I can operate this, I'll correct, first of all, the date on that. It is April 6th, not March 23rd. Uniform Law Commission is a national organization composed of members called commissioners from all 50 states and the District of Columbia, as well as some territories. The mission of the commission is to draft proposed uniform legislation on topics where some degree of uniformity among states is appropriate for consideration by the various state legislators. The ULC has been at this work for 130 years, and Alaska has been a member since 1912. In that time, the commission has drafted dozens and dozens of uniform acts, many of which have been enacted into law, including over 100 here in Alaska. ULC is headquartered in Chicago and is funded by the states, which pay dues proportionate to their population, and also by supported by a variety of grants and private foundations. There are approximately 350 commissioners, all attorneys. About 40% of those members are in private practice. The rest are government attorneys, sitting state legislators, and state or federal judges. Of course, many of the private practitioners and judges, and probably some of the government attorneys, are former legislators. So there's a robust group of commissioners with direct legislative experience, and others, like myself, who have served as legislative staff and are familiar with the legislative process. Each state determines the manner in which its commissioners are appointed. In Alaska, the governor appoints voting members, except for one voting member appointed by the Alaska Supreme Court. And as Rebecca mentioned, Director of Legal Services is ex officio member, and there are life members in Alaska. She described the members. I'll skip through that because we've done that. The commissioners serve without compensation. All commissioners attend the ULC's annual meeting, and we meet as a delegation three or four times a year to plan and review our legislative agenda. Individual commissioners serve as members of Uniform Law Commission study and drafting committees, which I'll talk about a bit more later. In addition, those of us who are not state employees, which at this point is myself and Deborah pretty much, are able to work with interested legislators in Alaska to introduce proposed uniform acts and to support the legislators in getting those proposals enacted as legislation. This is a flow chart that shows the process by which our draft acts come into being and how the process works. Ideas for proposed uniform acts come from individual commissioners, but of course they get their ideas from a variety of sources. Private practitioners may see a need for uniform legislation based on their own practice, law professors, they're in the business of generating ideas. Sitting and former legislators get their ideas from a variety of sources. I suppose you guys would know that as well as anybody. In any event, an individual commissioner sends a proposal for a uniform act to the ULC Scope and Program Committee, whose job it is to determine whether the proposal fits within the ULC guidelines for uniform acts. Primarily, they have two concerns. One, is uniformity among the states desirable? And two, is the proposal likely to be enacted by a substantial number of states? The commission simply doesn't want to get involved in the trouble of drafting proposed uniform acts that, however desirable or helpful, are simply not likely to be enacted. If approved by the Scope and Program Committee, the ULC president appoints a drafting committee to do the heavy lift of transforming an idea into proposed legislation. The drafting committees include a broad range of commissioners, including a number without any particular expertise or experience in the subject matter, to provide a layperson's perspective that the experts might lack. The drafting committee will also include commissioners with direct experience in the matter being considered, experts in the field, and representatives from interested parties, as well as a liaison to the appropriate committee at the American Bar Association. Drafting committees meet as often as necessary to come up with a draft. It may take a substantial period of time, just like drafting before the legislature. When a draft has been finalized, it's presented to the full commission along with a comprehensive draft committee report that outlines the issues, what decisions were made with respect to those issues, and why. The draft bill or draft uniform act must be approved by a majority of the states it's considered at two annual meetings, and it must be approved by a majority of the states. Each state gets one vote, just like in the U.S. Senate. If approved by the full commission, the ULC style committee then reviews the text and makes any changes that are necessary for editing purposes. Then the ULC legislative committee is charged with prioritizing proposed acts and providing direction and support to the various state delegations as they develop their own individual state plans for legislative action. ULC plays a unique role in that it provides a mechanism for states to take control of the legislative process in areas where federal legislation might otherwise be enacted, while at the same time maintaining consistency and uniformity in law at the state level. Of course, at the end of the day, however well-crafted and useful a proposed uniform act might be, enactment of a proposed uniform act is entirely subject to the ordinary state legislative process, which, as we know, is called sausage making. But the sausage making in the case of the Uniform Act is likely to be a little less messy than is generally the case. In the first place, as I said, the Commission doesn't draft an act unless it thinks it will be broadly adopted. These acts should be relatively non-controversial and nonpartisan. And they're going to be fully thought out and well drafted before being introduced in a state legislature. Of course, there's always going to be debate over particular choices embedded in the act, but that's as it should be. The ULC can provide support for proposed legislation from experts and interested parties as the legislator considers a uniform act. In today's highly interconnected environment, uniform state legislation can be a major benefit to the economy and to the social fabric. People, goods, and transactions can be located in multiple states, and it can be very helpful to have relatively similar rules in effect across the board. Having uniform legislation helps in the planning process so the problems don't arise, and in the dispute resolution process when problems arise. It helps avoid conflicts in applicable law as well as jurisdictional conflicts. Uniform acts can also modernize antiquated laws and legal doctrines and bring expert solutions to bear on emerging needs. We've done a lot of work in the last 15 years or so in the area of electronic commerce, for example, an entire aspect of the Uniform Commercial Law Code, which is one of the primary acts authored by the Uniform Law Commission, was completely revised, one segment of it, in order to cover electronic commerce. The areas that they most typically find suitable for uniform acts include commercial law, which I mentioned. The Uniform Commercial Code is the basic law that covers commercial transactions, banks, and secured transactions all across the country, and it's pretty much the same in every state as a result of the Uniform Commercial Code that the Uniform Law Commission enacted or proposed for legislatures. Business organization formation, that's partnerships and corporations. It's the Uniform Partnership Act. It's one of the primary things that the Uniform Law Commission authored, and that's in effect in pretty much every state. Family and domestic relations law, one of the big ones there that the Uniform Law Commission was involved in and promulgated, is the Uniform Child Custody Enforcement and Jurisdiction Act. You can only imagine the kinds of disputes that would have arisen in family matters when you have a family that's married in state A and parent lives in state B and the other parent is in state C, and you know, you've got kids to deal with in that circumstance. And that's a classic example of how important it can be to have uniform law and how improper it would be to have federal control over that. So that's an area where the Uniform Law Commission did a lot of very important work. The state's probate and trust, the Uniform Probate Code, again, is the Uniform Law Commission Act. That's pretty much universally the law. And again, if you think about the state's probate trust, you know, your property is in state A, you live in state B, you wrote your will in state C. How do you coordinate all that kind of stuff? Uniform Law Commission and the Uniform Law, Uniform Probate Code help resolve those kinds of disputes. Real estate transactions, similar kinds of issues, multiple states can be involved. Interstate enforcement of judgments, that's where you have a lawsuit in state A and you're trying to enforce the judgment in state B. We have various uniform acts that help with that process. In fact, we have some now that deal with international enforcement of judgments. One that I'd like to see worked on is one dealing with Canadian judgments. Mediation and arbitration, there is a Uniform Arbitration Act that's very pretty much universally adopted, and administrative procedure. Those are all areas that the Uniform Law Commission has done a substantial amount of work in. The process that the Uniform Act goes through in drafting these legislation is, you know, it's an open process with experts from various interested parties. And as I said before, you know, when you get back to the sausage making, there's no backroom deals being cut. There's no partisanship. This is all a matter of just trying to come up with the best solution to very common problems that arise across interjurisdictional situations. The Uniform Law Commission has 130 years of success, and they want to keep up with that. They're not going to bring to you things that will disrupt their reputation for nonpartisanship and thoroughness. And that part of that, of course, is just the value of the work that goes into creating these uniform acts with the volunteer expertise that's brought to bear. I will simply point you to our website, uniformlaws.org. It's got a lot of information about the organization and a complete list of acts that have been passed and that are proposed. And I would encourage legislators in general, any area of interest that you have, take a look and see if there's something that might bear on that in the Uniform Law Commission's website, because they can provide a great deal of help in terms of crafting legislation that will meet the needs of society today. With that, I'll give you my email address, amhnjh@gci.net, and if there's any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
I have one broad question. My sense is that in large measure, the uniform laws, you have stayed out of criminal law. Is that 100% true, or only in the smallest areas?
I believe that's 100%. They do not do criminal law. Is that correct?
For the chair, my name is Deborah Baer, and I am a life member of the Uniform Law Commission Alaska delegation. Right now, we have a study committee on cybercrime, and it was requested by the National Sheriffs Association. The sheriffs were saying they just couldn't keep up with all the changes in technology. And the new, as soon as they would think of a way to deal with the crime, a new way to do it would come out. Also, they want to know about civil remedies that might be available in a situation where it's possible that the person who is done the bad act is not accessible to them through the criminal system. And so we now have a study committee on that. It is one that any member of your staff might want to list and listen to. If you can listen to it for free, get on the list. And so although we do try to avoid it primarily because each state, that's an issue that each state generally tries to set their own penalties for, this is an area where they've asked for help from us, the National Sheriff's Association.
That would be more the exception than the rule.
Yes. Yes, sir.
Questions from committee members? Representative Snyder.
I think I know the answer then, but just to confirm, in this case, the ULC would not be a resource to turn to with questions regarding consent as it pertains to sexual assault, for example.
Through the chair, Deborah Baer again. Yes, I think that's so. We would probably not take that as an issue that is likely to pass uniformly between all the 50 states.
And I know that you had handed out a one-page handout about items of interest for Alaska. Ms. Baer, did you want to go over that before we run out of time?
Certainly. I'll try to do it briefly because I know you're on a very tight time schedule.
Y'all are doing great. So.
We're doing great? Okay, great. Again, I'm Deborah Baer. I'd like to go over the sheet, and you'll see at the bottom it's dated March 12th. Nothing has happened since March 12th. The Uniform Law Commission, our gold standard act, is the Uniform Commercial Code. If you have ever bought a car on time or have bought a stereo on time, you are under the Uniform Commercial Code. All states have this in some form or another, and what it does is facilitate when somebody sells a product across state lines, what happens if the product is no good, or if the product fails, or if somebody doesn't pay as long as they promised. That answers all those questions. What we're looking at now, and this is a drafting committee, is what happens with these new emerging technologies such as like Bitcoin, cryptocurrency, non-fungible tokens, where you set up commercial ways to deal with electronics to do these kinds of bills. Right now, the Uniform Commercial Code nationwide does not address it. And so what it does is set up a vacuum where people aren't sure what's going to happen. So people are going to be reluctant to deal with cryptocurrency and things in commerce. This drafting committee is of the nationwide drafting experts in this area in all areas. And it's going to take a couple of years to do it, but they're working on it right now. The second thing I wanted to bring to your attention is electronic wills. I know during the pandemic, the legislature passed an amendment to allow for video conferencing of witnessing wills, and that has since expired. I would suggest that you might want to look at the Uniform Electronic Wills Act. The nice thing about it is it allows someone to do a will that is not on paper at all. Traditionally, a will was on paper, and you'd have witnesses in front of you signing it, and the person who's giving the gifts would sign it as well. What they have found is, especially with young people, they don't use paper anymore. Everything is electronic. Like, for example, our permanent fund dividend applications, they're electronic. You sign them, you have penalties that come out of them, and the world is moving. So it's not something that you can say, well, I'd rather keep it paper. It's going to go on without you, and then you have a major issue for the courts. What do you do with an electronic will? And then some people want to have their will signed with their witnesses. Say they have two sons. One could be in the service overseas. One could be in New York City, and they want them to witness the wills. Why should they have to fly to Alaska to sit in an office and sign a will when it can all be done electronically by video conferencing? This bill addresses that, and it's this bill is final and is ready for a review by your staff or whoever is interested in the subject. And the final one I just spoke a little bit about is the cybercrime bill, and it's been requested, and we're just starting that. It's a study committee, and they're really interested in the National Sheriff's Association and seeing some uniform solution to crimes that occur in all 50 states, in essence. I'll be happy to answer any questions you have.
The only question I had about areas they may be working on not on the list is, what about data privacy? Is that something the Uniform Law Commission is looking at, and what's the status of a potentially ULC bill that addresses data privacy.
Yeah, this is Deborah Bear again. We have a bill on the subject, and it's available for your review. It's on the internet. Andy's gave you the website. If you can't find it easily, contact Andy or I, we can help.
But it's actually been through review, and it's in a form to be adopted by legislators.
I believe so. That's off the top of my head. I believe so. If not, it's in the very, very final stages.
Okay. Any other questions? I know the bells are ringing, so we don't have a lot of time. Any other questions, Representative Drummond, Representative Snyder? I don't see anything. I appreciate your coming down, and I appreciate the reminder about electronic wills. It feels like something we talked about, and I know we adopted it wasn't a ULC law, but we adopted a provisions regarding electronic notary and remote notary, which wasn't a uniform law, and I think that's the provision where you added the electronic signatures for wills. So
electronic notarization.
Electronic notarization, but we don't have electronic wills, so that may be something to look into. But seeing no other questions from the committee, we're going.
Mr. Chairman, sorry.
Representative Drummond.
Thank you. I just had a thought. Is this updating the will signing by video conference? Is that something that perhaps a committee bill can correct this late in the legislative session? Is that something that people are expecting to be able to do?
What happened was that we added that to our electronic notary bill, but it had a time expiration. Mm-hmm. So we didn't make it a permanent deal. It's certainly the subject that we could look into. It could be the subject of a committee bill. I would suggest, given kind of the time in the session, I would start by contacting folks in the family or the estate planning bar to see if there's a need for it, mm-hmm. in terms of the time, the speed or lack of speed thereof. My sense has been that the electronic notary did more to ease that process than anything else, and that would still be in place. All right. We will now adjourn for the day. Our next meeting is Friday, April 8th at 1 p.m. It will stand adjourned. I'd note that on our list for Friday is the Alaska Victimization Study and a report on that from a professor at the University of Alaska. And with that, we'll stand adjourned. The time is now 2 p.m.